Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Steps Oral Argument, Trump v. Mazars USA and Trump v. Vance. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Mr. Devin Watkins, an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He previously worked at Cato as a legal associate and interned at the Institute for Justice. At the Cato Institute, Watkins worked on a variety of Supreme Court cases, and one of the briefs he worked on was cited by the court. His op-eds have appeared in National Review, The Hill, Time, and The Federalist, among others. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will go to Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Mr. Watkins, the floor is yours.
I'm glad to be here. So in talking about the oral arguments, I want to start with one thing. I'm not a mind reader. I don't know how the justices will decide the case. That said, the questions of the justices sometimes provide clues as how they're likely to vote or what direction they tend to be heading. Sometimes we think they're going one way and they end up going another way. So nothing we say that was said today, they could have been acting, for instance, as devil's advocate, arguing something that they even themselves don't believe. So we don't know for certain how the court is going to go until we see the final decision. The cases today dealt with the financial records of President Trump. Most importantly, his tax returns, but there were a lot of other financial records related to his businesses and a variety of other financial records other than just the tax returns, although that was obviously a very critical element. I'm going to start with the cases that were first on the docket, which is the congressional subpoenas. These are subpoenas that were issued by three committees of the House of Representatives against President Trump for his financial records. As you may know, a variety of previous presidents had issued and distributed their tax returns, but President Trump had not. And there were a variety of people in the House of Representatives that wanted access to those, and they subpoenaed them. And the key question that comes before the court is there a legitimate legislative purpose for this? The House of Representatives, in the text of the Constitution, doesn't actually say anywhere that they have the power to subpoena anything. And so that power has been implied from the other powers of Congress. But to be able to do that, there has to be some type of legitimate legislative purpose. So the right wing of the court tended to focus primarily on these balance of power issues at stake. What is the source of this congressional subpoena power? What are its limits? Especially because it doesn't appear directly in the text of the Constitution. These limits also must be implied if this power exists. The left wing of the court didn't focus as much on the direct questions like that, but more on the history, because there's a lot of history of subpoenas by various House committees, and it's very, very broad. They focused on the Paula Jones case, the Whitewater case, and the subpoenas were issued for various Hillary Clinton private records. And in these cases, they weren't actually challenged. So a lot of times the Congress would submit the subpoena to the president or someone else, and then they would enter into negotiations on exactly how much to give. The president says, we're not going to give you everything you want, but we'll give you something. And Congress says, okay, that's good enough, and they're given the records. So the question first is, how much does this historical precedent actually provide some type of precedent as to the constitutional powers and limits of Congress? If everything that was provided voluntarily was something that Congress could have subpoenaed and got it anyway, or was it something that perhaps Congress couldn't have done, but the president decided to give it to them anyway? It's very tricky there. And the left wing of the court was very focused on the history of all of the subpoenas and the records being provided, even of the president or people high up in the administration. The next question dealt with personal records or official records. So there's a lot, everyone acknowledges that Congress has to understand the operations of government to be able to legislate properly. And so that has one standard. It's done quite often where the subpoenas are issued. But for personal records like this, the question is, what is that standard? Is it the same as the official standard? Is it higher or is it lower? The left-wing of the court suggested that there should be a lower standard than for official records, because official records implicate the core operations of very important functions of government, and these personal records don't have those implications. And the next question had to do with the what was sometimes referred to as the Nixon standard, a heightened inquiry. There was a lot of the court had gone and considered the subpoena to Nixon. And so obviously a subpoena issued to the president was going to be very important to deciding these subpoenas that were issued to the president. There was a lot of differences, though, between the Nixon standard and these standards. One of the most important differences is that Nixon had raised a claim of executive privilege. This is the privilege that extends between the president and his closest advisors about closely held discussions on what the president should do. And when those advisors are advising the president, there's a very important protection there that those be kept somewhat secret so that the people advising the president feel free to give their candid advice rather than advice that they may not want to give if it were publicly revealed later. And in the case of Nixon, the court had held that there's a heightened inquiry into, is this really needed? Is there some other way to get these records? You know, there has to be something more than just the normal subpoena amount. And the question is that because it was the president being submitted the subpoena, or is it because he had raised the idea that this was protected by executive privilege? The left wing of the court emphasized the executive privilege claim very strongly. And I've been focusing primarily on the questioning of the government's counsel. They were the first ones to come up. But then the committee's lawyer came up to try to defend these subpoenas. And probably the biggest question, the most important question in my mind that was submitted to the committee's attorney was by the Chief Justice. This was whether he can give any example of a subpoena that would be invalid because there was no legitimate legislative purpose. The Chief Justice was basically asking for a limiting principle. How far can you go and no further? And the committee's lawyer could not come up with a single example, could not say any kind of subpoena that wouldn't potentially lead to legislation and therefore be a legitimate legislative purpose. And this becomes much, much worse as you go on and you see a lot of the other justices continue to reiterate this point, because if the only limitation on the subpoena power was this legitimate legislative purpose, and any subpoena would meet that standard, it really wasn't a limitation at all. So that was probably the biggest point. I got to say, personally, I came into this rather split. I didn't know which side would win. There's a lot of history, you know, the left wing of the court was pointing to it, where a lot of previous subpoenas by Congress was issued to the president or other people, and the court gave very broad latitude to congressional subpoenas on the legitimate legislative purpose was very broad, and it was hard to see anything that would be limited to it. But when you actually see the government, the committee's attorney come up and say that basically any subpoena could be valid if the committee wanted to investigate that. It seemed like there was a lot of pushback to that idea, even by some of the left wing of the court, which suggested that may be going too far. Thomas, of course, suggested that the subpoena power might not exist at all. It isn't mentioned anywhere in the Constitution, so why does the committees have any power at all? I wouldn't be surprised to see either dissent or concurrence by Thomas that suggests that there isn't such a power. He probably isn't going to have anyone else. He might get Gorsuch to join him, but probably no one else. But at the moment, it looked like all of the right wing of the court seem to be supporting the president, and left wing of the court is probably opposed to the president on this issue. And so I'm suspecting that it'll probably be 5-4 in that way. But it's hard to know. One of the justices could change their mind, or, could be reading a little bit too much into their questions. So now I'd like to go into the second case here, Trump v. Vance. Both of these cases concern the financial records of the president, including his tax returns. But Trump v. Vance dealt with a local grand jury subpoena rather than a congressional subpoena. It doesn't have the legitimate legislative purpose requirement behind it, but instead has another requirement that it has to be kind of relevant to these potential criminal investigations of various misconduct. So the president's attorney, a personal attorney, there was actually two different attorneys, one representing the president personally, and then there was another attorney representing the United States by the Department of Justice. So the president's personal attorney put forward the argument that the president cannot be investigated at all for any criminal behavior by any state or local attorney while he's in office. This was quite a stretch. So I got to say, I listened to the arguments before when they were at the lower court, and I did not see them as very likely to have a lot of weight going forward. But they brought them up again before the court, but I didn't see almost any of the justices that seemed to go along with that. Even Justice Thomas, which was the next to ask questions, asked, where does this immunity come from in the Constitution? It isn't listed anywhere in the Constitution. What historical precedent for this immunity exists? The attorney for the president talked about some letters being discussed among the founders about how there could be hostile process against the president. But to me, it seemed very weak on the arguments that were given. Now, the DOJ argument was a lot more refined. They didn't argue the kind of blanket immunity that Trump's personal attorney argued. They instead argued for a special needs standard as to why the local or state prosecutor needed the information. They had to show something more than, yeah, maybe there might be a crime in there. Let's go dig through the financial records and see if we can find something. They got to do more than a fishing exercise. They got to meet, is there another way that they could get this information without subpoenaing the private records of the president? Is there some reason that they have to have it now rather than later after the president is out of office? The interesting thing is that the New York attorney, he had a standard that was mostly similar to the DOJ standard, but he flipped the order. So rather than the DOJ standard, which basically says to the attorney, you're requesting this information, okay, give us why you need this information, let the court consider that, and then we'll move on to the other privileges and other claims are. The New York attorney says, we submit the subpoena, and then it's the president's responsibility to come and say why that subpoena should be quashed. What is the Second Amendment interest that's potentially harmed here? And then the court is kind of balance that Article 2 interest. The Article 2 interest that's potentially harmed. And then the court can balance the interest in Article 2 against the interests of the local or state attorney to try to get the information so that they can bring a potential case. And one of the other interesting or important aspects to this isn't necessarily the prosecution of the president, either after he's out of office or whenever, but the prosecution of other people that are closely associated with the president. For instance, imagine the president is talking with someone else on the phone or via email, and this local or state attorney wants to prosecute not the president, but that other person. Can the attorney go and get that email without going through all this rigmarole and heightened standard and stuff like that? Do they have to go to federal court to ask permission to get these just because they were talking with the president rather than the target of the investigation? I definitely see a lot of similarities, and I saw among the justices' questions, and Justice Gorsuch had asked what the differences are. He didn't see almost any differences between the DOJ position and the New York position. So I suspect that the justices are probably going to pick something that's kind of an amalgam of the DOJ position and the New York position, maybe a little bit more towards one side or more towards the other side, where it won't be kind of a blanket, absolute, no immunity, absolute immunity to any investigation of the president, but more some type of special standard, some type of heightened standard when they're going to seek the records of the president. Maybe they'll require the president to say why there's some harm to an Article II interest first. They will probably say that there's going to be something more than just a fishing exercise into the president's records. That said, both DOJ and New York agree that this should be decided in federal court, not state court. That's important because state courts and are going to be more amenable to the local interests of that state and not the more federal interests of the entire United States. So the key problems from the New York point of view is the statute of limitations. As the president's attorneys argue, if there's an absolute blanket immunity to any investigation at all, the statute of limitations might run before the president gets out of office and they can investigate these things. That would lead to them never being prosecuted at all for the crime. And that doesn't make any sense at all. There has to be some way that the statute of limitations is either told, which there's not currently in law and statutes or in the Supreme Court's precedent, but perhaps they might add some type of tolling provision to the statute of limitations. I'm not sure about that yet. But if there, that was suggested by several of the justices' questions, but we don't know yet if they're going to actually think about adding that or not. But even if there is or isn't a statute of limitations problem, it seems likely that the court is going to say that there can be investigations of the president or people closely associated with the president at the local level with the protections that the grand jury provisions apply. So that means that there would be protections that would prevent this information, even though it was given to the grand jury and the local prosecutor, from them being distributed to the public. So those are kind of my initial thoughts for how the oral arguments went today and how I see the cases likely to be going.
We'll now go to the first question.
Thanks. This is Danny Ogden in Waco, Texas. I thought one of Justice Breyer's questions was quite interesting when he brought up in the future case, perhaps you might have Senator Joe McCarthy. I can't remember the exact words, but something about subpoena, something of a Franklin Roosevelt. And I thought that really was quite telling as to the skepticism of Breyer as to the House subpoena, just like your comments on that, please.
Yeah, there seemed to be a lot of discussion and at least here among the justices that either these subpoenas or at least are used for harassment and in other ways trying to undermine the presidency. And there was a lot of fear that if they set too low a standard for what subpoenas could be issued, that that would be a problem.
Thank you. Let's go to the next question.
Okay. Hey, this is Mike Stern in Virginia. Thank you, Devin, for that summary. I think that was an excellent description of the cases. My question is, there is currently pending in the D.C. Circuit en banc the McGahn case, which revolves around whether the House has standing to sue the former White House counsel to make him testify. Do you think the arguments today will have any bearing on that? And do you think the court, the D.C. Circuit, is likely to wait to see how the court comes down, or do you think it won't have any effect?
I wouldn't be surprised if the D.C. Circuit waits and how the Supreme they don't want to get this decided, and then maybe there's some small difference in the change that in the Supreme Court opinion that invalidates one piece of their opinion, they have to redo it again. My guess is they're going to wait and see, and it probably isn't going to have a huge impact on that case. That said, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some pretty strong limits to the subpoena power of Congress. I don't know if these are going to be generalized, though. They may be very specific limitations when the Congress is trying to subpoena presidential records. They may not be generalizable even to close advisors like Kim.
We'll now go to a caller from D.C.
Yes, I listened to the argument also, and I just to run a thought by you. I've sensed bipartisan concern with the issue of the burden Breyer raised that in particular on the left side, but several on the right side raised it. I can see a court sort of adopting the absolutist decision, a position rather of Jay Sekulow, which I think was a bad argument, by the way, a bad argument to raise, but couching it in with a time frame. In other words, the burden is potentially so great on the president while he's serving in office that unless there's some special need to advance an investigation while the president is sitting, that the investigation for whether it involves presidential documents or presidential depositions or whatnot must wait until the president leaves office, given the following risk that, and Brian raised this, that when documents are requested, even if they're private documents, the president has to spend time and make judgments as to what should be disclosed and confirm with his lawyers about that. When documents are disclosed, and this was a question that I think Leo alluded to, once the investigation is underway at the state level, while the president is still sitting, that investigation has repercussions on the capacity of the president to perform his office, even if the investigation is only of private matters. He cited the Clinton impeachment as an example of that. Do you think that the Clinton investigation had no lasting effect after the investigation was concluded? The counsel for the city tried to get around that, but he did not. And the third example is that the production of documents, once they're made, once they are released to the grand jury, the suggestion was made, and you can almost hear the snicker on some sides of the bench, that the confidentiality of those documents cannot be assured. Regardless of what the law says, they will be leaked and used publicly for political purposes. So I can see, and I want your response to this, I can see a decision which says we won't adopt an absolute standard that the president cannot be investigated while he's sitting, but we will adopt a standard which says the investigation will be barred while the president is sitting, unless you can make a compelling showing of the need for that investigation and a compelling showing that the investigation will not intrude upon the president's capacity to perform his job, either at the time of the investigation or thereafter while he's sitting in office, and unless you can show, Mr. State Prosecutor, that the production of documents will not, under any circumstances, be made public for any purpose.
So the question of burden is obviously very important, and I'll deal with that, and then I'll get to the second question there. The question of burden, I think, was pretty broadly understood as potentially existing here. As the New York attorney liked to say, yeah, we didn't subpoena the president. We only subpoenaed the three-party person, and therefore there was no actual burden on the president. But that was rather absurd, and I think a lot of the justices realized that from their question. Even Justice Breyer seemed to realize that there is actually a burden on the president. These are his records. He has to go into court. He has to talk to his attorneys. You know, one of the lawyers for the president was like, what am I supposed to do as the attorney for the president? To go and talk to him and say, yeah, I need to go talk to you for 3 or 4 hours about these documents. You're just going to have to stop your day and dealing with the coronavirus and everything else that's going on to go deal with that. And so I think it was pretty obvious that there is at least some burden on the president. Now, the question is how much of a burden? And, you know, is the court going to say that this burden is possibly too much to stop these subpoenas? I think the court is going to acknowledge that it may get too far, it may get too burdensome, and the court may have to stop in. But I'm not sure that this case in particular is going to reach that case. I doubt the Supreme Court is going to say either way in this. I suspect they're going to remand back to a lower court to deal with the burden issues and some of the other stuff once they define the standard. But more likely, I think they're going to say this probably doesn't meet that standard, but it's hard to say. There's obviously people on the right wing of the court that saw this as a very strong burdensome, and people on the left wing of the court that saw this as very little burdensome, not that big of a problem. But it was fairly widely acknowledged that there's at least some burden imposed, and that if there were a tremendous number of subpoenas issued by a lot of different prosecutors and a lot of different congressional subpoenas and a lot of other stuff, that these kind of things could add up to being too much and really interfere with the president's ability to conduct his office. So I think that was something that was very clear and was very much on the mind of all of the justices. Even some of the left wing of the court realized and acknowledged that these are potential burdens that the court has to watch out for. The question is this going to be more of a per se thing? There's probably a few people, especially Alito, that seem to really push hard for this to be more of kind of a per se, too burdensome, we got to stop this while the president's in office. The left wing court obviously was totally opposite. Now this is fine. The courts will just balance this and move forward. And I think they saw this as that big problem. It's hard to say exactly where the court is going to end up. I doubt it's going to be a per se rule, but no doubt that will be a huge part of whatever tests that the court comes out with in the end. So what was the, there was a second part to your question, besides burden, but I'm not remembering it at the moment. Let me think. I'm sorry.
Caller, if you'd like to ask that second question again, Devin, do you happen to have predictions on the eventual ruling of any of these cases? I know at the outset you said you don't have a crystal ball, but you must have.
Sure. So I suspect that the congressional ruling is probably going to be 5-4 against the committee. They're probably not going to say, no, the Supreme, you can't ever subpoena the presidential records, but they're going to raise the bar a bit. They're going to say, in this particular case, you didn't lay out enough of a standard of why this meets the legislative purpose, and they're going to send it back to lower court on that basis. That the four on the left wing of the court are going to dissent from that. I think Thomas is going to have a concurrence and probably say that the legislative subpoena power doesn't exist. On the other case, I think it's probably going to be unanimous that the president has no absolute immunity from any criminal investigation. While I think that probably is with the court. That said, the court will probably try to get a standard fairly close to what the DOJ is saying, but with some substantive caveats. I wouldn't be surprised if that opinion was unanimous in the end.
Caller from 703, you're on the line.
I am. Sorry about that. I listened to the oral arguments, but I have not read the briefs, and I thought that the advocate for the House of Representatives did a very poor job of explaining why the House of Representatives wanted these records. And I was wondering, was that just a failure of oral advocacy and the briefs made it more clear? And what was the reason why the House was asking for these?
It's hard to know. I mean, I could pick out, if I was the attorney for the House of Representatives, I could have devised a very clear limiting principle, explain why these subpoenas are well within the legislative purpose, and I don't think it would have been all that difficult. The question of why they didn't do that is a more difficult question, I think. It may just be the attorney for the House of Representatives. They felt that they didn't want to limit the House of Representatives' subpoena power in any way. And anything that they concede would be a limitation on the power of the House of Representatives. And as their attorney, they felt that they didn't want to make any of those concessions. I think substantially weaken their case by not, by basically saying the standard that I am proposing has no limits. Anytime you're doing that before the court, it's a really bad idea.
We'll now go to our next caller.
Hello, my name is Ken Conop, and I'm in Michigan. And I have really a couple of questions, maybe three. The first question is, I have not seen the subpoena, but I do enough litigation to understand that once you have a tax return, which is, I don't know if you guys are tax guys, called a 1040, the 1040 gathers information frequently for people who have a lot of business interests from other tax returns. And the tax return, when you do the 1040, has a one-page form from another partnership or other entity. So there could be, I don't know anything about President Trump's taxes, obviously, but there could be dozens and dozens of other entities in which he has all or part of an interest. So am I correct in assuming they could then subpoena all these other partnerships or LLCs or whatever the heck he's got if he has money out of a trust? And then can they also, in effect, audit it? So they see a deduction for, you know, travel and expenses, so they could ask him for his, you know, his MasterCard record and his phone records. They could ask him for, you know, and this is almost an endless audit of the return. I guess that's the part I don't, just as a practical matter, I don't really understand. And the second question is, this is, I don't understand criminal jurisdiction, but what I take it New York has jurisdiction over this because President Trump was or is, whatever the heck he is, a New York resident. I assume a prosecutor in Kansas or in Michigan couldn't start state law proceedings against the president. And the third question, which I think you've alluded to pretty clearly, and that is that a lot of this is obviously politically driven. And I don't know if you can prove it or not, but wasn't there some cases in California or someplace where the judge commented on, you know, about what some comment President Trump made at some press conference? How much was that emphasized? Thank you very much.
So let me deal with the first question. I'm sure the 1040 does talk about a lot of other entities associated with the president or the president owns or whatnot. But the House of Representatives has already preempted you. They've already subpoenaed those records of the other organization. They didn't just subpoena the president's personal records. They subpoenaed the Trump Organization's records and a whole bunch of LLCs and other entities that are closely associated with the president. So even if they didn't get the tax records in particular, they subpoenaed those other entities' records already. So they're definitely saying that they should have access to those records. Let's see. You asked about the criminal jurisdiction. Yeah, in this case, it is the New York attorney. President Trump he lived in New York. These entities, many of them are New York entities. And this is why the New York attorney is investigating potential violations of New York law as related to either President Trump or these entities. And that's where the criminal jurisdiction comes from. And I did remember the other question that was given by the previous caller. This had to do with the revealing of these records. So officially, as grand jury records, they are prohibited from being disclosed publicly. There is always a fear that they might get leaked. And there were some of the justices that questioned, you know, we might turn it over to you, and then it shows up in the New York Times the next day. And it definitely appeared to be a risk. I think it was Alito that had questioned about this. I think in the back of the mind, the justices understand that there is at least a risk that the information could get leaked, even if officially there's an order not to. The New York attorney did everything he could to suggest that that doesn't happen, that won't happen. He isn't aware of any kind of grand jury information that got leaked like that in the past, and it won't happen at all in this case. Some of the justices, I'm sure, believed him. Some of the justices, I'm sure, didn't believe him. And some of the justices, I'm sure, aren't sure. But I'm sure that is in the back of their mind. Oh, and as it relates to the political nature of this. I think it was very clear to the justices that there is politics involved, but anytime that the court is dealing with different branches of government litigating against each other, there's usually politics involved. And the court doesn't like to call that out too much if it doesn't have to. And so it tends to be a lot in the background. I'm sure it's in the mind of the justices. They know the political situation. But the question they're crafting isn't really for Trump. Yes, Trump is the person that is going to be directly decided about. But they're trying to craft rules that are not going to be about Trump, but about future presidents as well. And when you consider the long term of any court decision, how that can impact Republican administrations, Democratic administrations, all kinds of different stuff. So it isn't necessarily kind of a pure politics thing. From the justices' point of view, they have to decide this question for the next 30 years. And that's very important. That makes a lot less about the current political situation.
Well, I think that's the first time one person has ever answered four questions back to back to back to back to back. So congrats. We'll now go to our next caller.
Okay. Yes, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to watch the arguments this morning. I taped them, so I'll watch them later. But when we're talking about congressional subpoenas, I worked in the Senate for several years, and I was general counsel on a committee, and we did a lot of investigations. So I believe there is a legitimate use to congressional subpoena power when it's properly used. We did all sorts of investigations, like with the Takata airbags or the GM ignition interlock situation, where there was ample evidence of a consumer protection issue, and we subpoenaed companies for documents, and yes, spent a lot of hours going through documents, but there was a tighter tie. What did the House counsel articulate as their legislative need or the direct tie of evidence that this would fulfill it rather than be a fishing expedition?
So do a very good job of that. They could have done a lot better, that's for sure. But there were a lot of different legislative purposes that were at least raised, if not by the counsel, then by other justices. The biggest tended to be either, probably the most important was on disclosure. There are statutes right now that require certain disclosures of financial information of the president. And potentially, the legislature might be looking to amend those statutes, maybe to expand them or change them in some way. And the idea is somehow by looking at the president's financial information, they can then realize what they should have been asking for in those statutes. And so they can move forward with a legislation that would amend them. That was probably the strongest case they put forward. There was a few others around potential maybe conflict of interest cases. And the left wing of the court also seemed to make a very strong difference between the financial services subpoena, which was very broad about all kinds of records of the president and all kinds of different organizations associated with the president, and the Intelligence Committee subpoena, which they said there's a very legitimate purpose in trying to see what kind of foreign influence might impact the president. And so those kind of foreign relations impacts. Now, even the president's counsel and the DOJ counsel seem to suggest that it's possible that the Intelligence Committee subpoena might be valid, but they have to do a better job of kind of explaining why and perhaps limiting it slightly so that perhaps they only subpoena certain records with foreign individuals or things like that. In a situation like that, they would say, okay, that's valid purpose. You can go forward with that. But they said that these were, one, very broad. They went back a very long time, and so they weren't really connected to the legislative purpose that was being claimed. And secondly, that the, like, many of these didn't even explain at all why it was legislative purpose. Like, considering possible legislation that might amend it on these, which isn't really enough to really go forward and say what exactly the legislative purpose was.
Doesn't look like we have any questions in the queue. Devin, is there anything you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Let's see. I suspect that the first one, the congressional subpoenas, is going to be highly contested. But if, as I suspect, the second one is a unanimous decision, hopefully people can see at least a little bit of unity on the court and moving forward on things like that.
Absolutely. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.